Hello, everybody. My name is Stephen Downs, and it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you today. I'm hoping you're able to hear my audio okay. And if you do hear my audio okay, please do indicate in the chat window, and that will give me some feedback that I need. And I see. And I'm hearing messages that the sound is fine. And somebody is flicking the. Oh, I have no control over this. There we go. So, okay, whoever's advancing the slides, please stop. Anyhow, it's a pleasure to be able to talk with all of you today. My topic for today is lifelong learning. And my intention today is to set up this topic with respect to the talk that I will be giving in Caracas in a few weeks. If you are not able to be in Venezuela, do not worry. This talk and my talk in Caracas will both be available online on my website, and I'm sure at the conference website. I want to begin by having us think about what we think of when we think of lifelong learning. Do we think of classrooms and going back to school again and opening the books and taking notes? No, as Fabiana is saying in the chat, not exactly. Generally, when we think about learning after we've left school, after we've left the world of classes, we think of learning more like it's pictured here, more like talking and interacting with our friends and colleagues. We think of lifelong learning as an ongoing process, as something that happens every day. As this diagram shows, we may go through different steps in the course of learning for ourselves. What's important to understand is that it's an ongoing process, not something that simply starts and stops again. There are many models of learning this way. Here's one that is an adaptation from Kolb. Oh, different translator. You can see the different steps that are described here, the descriptions, the feelings, the analysis, the action plan. These all are different aspects of our process of lifelong learning. And we see learning as something that's much more active, much more engaging. It's almost like science, where we try things out and try to make sense of the experience that results. I have my own theory of learning. It's a very simple theory, perhaps too simple to be called a theory, and it's not really my own. It's borrowed from many other writers. It is this. To teach is to model and demonstrate. To learn is to practice and reflect. Like I said, it's a very simple theory. I raise it here in order to bring out the idea that there are two sides to the learning equation. On the one side, we have the teaching side, which is to model and demonstrate. And on the other side, we have the learning side, which is to practice and reflect. I think that before we can discuss the teaching side usefully, it's important to spend some time and reflection on the learning side. That's what this presentation will be about. This presentation will be about personal learning, the actual action of practice and reflection that we all undertake. What we will do is today we'll talk about learning, and then whoever's messing with the slides, please stop. Today we'll talk about the learning side, and then we'll discuss how we learn in the online forums over the next 3 weeks. And then that will lead to my discussion of the teaching side, open courses and MOOCs, during my talk in Caracas. So for this presentation, I want you to do more than simply sit back and listen to what I'm saying. I want you to think about how you learn. I'll be talking about some aspects of personal learning, but I want you to be thinking about whether these apply to you, because my descriptions are only about myself. Only you can decide for yourself how you learn. Over the years, I've divided the field of personal learning into three major principles, which are interaction, usability, and relevance. It's important to understand that these principles are not laws of nature. They're not describing reality itself. They're just heuristic devices that I use to frame the discussion, just a tool to make the language easier to work with. So with that understanding, let's look at the first principle. The first principle is the principle of interaction. This is the idea that we learn from others and other people learn from us. The picture in the diagram was created by Scott Wilson, who was describing a structure of online learning based on interaction. But there's more to interaction than just the technology. And indeed, in learning, I think it's more important to focus on the human side, why we want to interact with other people at all. I did a presentation in French. One day I'll do one in Spanish. I did one in French just the other day where I talked about two types of learning community. The one type of community is the one we're familiar with. It's like Etienne Wenger's communities of practice, and it's based around the topic or discipline that we want to learn about. But the other type of community, in French, communauté de pair, or peer community, is the community of people who are around you, that support you, that you live with and work with. The The idea here is that community is based not only in knowledge, but it's also based in practice. It's based not only in theory, but based in where you live. If we think of traditional learning, learning based on classes and lectures and even events like this, we find that we cannot depend on this type of learning for interactivity. In traditional learning, it's more about sitting and receiving content rather than interacting and acting in a community. Oops. Isn't that interesting? In order to obtain interaction, whether in a work or learning environment, you have to build your own interaction network and place yourself at the center of this network. You can see some of the tools that the person in the diagram is using there to create connections with other people out there in the world. Tools like Flickr and YouTube, perhaps Yahoo or MSN, or even Google, or repositories of learning resources. It's important to think of all the different ways you connect with other people. It's popular today to talk about Web 2.0 and social networking, but even things like email and mailing lists and online discussions are also important sources of connections with other people. It's also important to remember that interaction works in two directions, not just one. That's why we have arrows on both sides of the lines in the diagram. So you should be thinking about how you are sending communications to other people. For example, are you sending email? Are you writing a blog or tweeting? When we learn in the workplace, when we do personal professional development, we are interested in creating a personal network of contacts. This network may be formal or informal. It may be in the workplace or outside the workplace. And I know I'm sure all of you know how to communicate with others in a network, but I think it's worth reminding ourselves of some principles of interaction. For example, pull is better than push. People should receive messages that they want, not messages that you're trying to force on them. Speaking in your own voice rather than an artificial voice conveys your own experiences more authentically. What you have to share is important, and be free to share your knowledge, your experiences, and your opinions. And interaction with others should become a habit and a priority. It may seem like it's extra work, but it's actually something that reduces the extra work. If interaction isn't provided in your learning environment or your workplace, then you should take steps to create it yourself by creating a blog or a Twitter network. Many people are challenged by barriers in the workplace or in the school, preventing them from communicating. Software may be blocked, for example, and you need to find ways to work around these barriers. As I'm sure you understand, if you are not interacting, you are not learning. And so creating the space for interaction needs to be a learning priority. The second principle of personal learning that I want to talk about is usability. And we talked about usability a lot on the web, but I want to talk about it in terms of simplicity and consistency. If you think of the most usable websites, like, say, Google, you know that they're very easy to understand, and you know what to expect every time you go back to them. These are the two major principles for your own learning as well. Consistency, knowing what to expect, and simplicity, knowing how things work. I once wrote a paper called Things You Really Need to Learn. And there were 10 major things in that paper. But I think sometimes that those 10 things actually reduce to these two things, consistency and simplicity. From the perspective of your own personal learning, what these principles mean is taking charge of your own learning, managing your own learning for yourself. I'm sure those of you who are in professional positions understand the importance of managing your own learning rather than leaving it to someone else. It's important to think of your own knowledge and your own learning as something that belongs to you, as though it's an asset that you have, and to begin to organize and manage it for yourself. One example of this is to clarify your first principles. What things do you believe are true and underlie the foundations of your other knowledge? For myself, for example, I believe that knowledge originates in experience. I believe that experience is what teaches us about the world around us. As a consequence, when I organize my knowledge, I organize it based on my experiences. I organize my photos by the trips that I've taken. I organize my talks and presentations according to the order in which I presented them. My knowledge very much reflects my experience. I also organize and represent my knowledge in an explicit manner, for example, on my own website. This isn't just an accidental arrangement of topics that I have on my website. It's the result of me working and reworking and reworking the organization of my knowledge over the course of years. A way of thinking about this is, I have a model of the world in my head. A picture of where all the things go. So when I have new experiences, I know what to expect from those experiences, where they belong in this model. The other side of this is to simplify. And there's a simple rule for that. Summarize, summarize, summarize. What's happening when you are doing this is you are taking the information that you've been given by other people, by your friends you interact with, and you are adapting that information, that knowledge, to your own model by putting it into your own words. Simplicity is a matter of perspective. What's simple for me might be complex for you. What's complex for you might be simple for me. So simplifying is always a matter of translating. People can see how I implement this in my own practice by looking at my newsletter, OL Daily, which I send out every day. This newsletter is really a combination of the first two major principles of personal learning, the principle of interactivity and the principle of usability. And to me, what's important is not simply the fact that I am simplifying and rewriting things in my own words, but that I am doing this publicly. And so I'm subject to the correction of errors and the addition of additional information. What's important here is that you own your own language, that you use your words, and you decide how you are going to describe things to yourself. Every vocabulary, every set of words, every language is a way of looking at the world, a perspective. And if you have others tell you what words must mean, then you are letting others tell you how you must see the world. But you can only decide this for yourself. Think of usability also as social. Can you search through your own structure? Can you represent similar things in similar ways? But usability is also personal. Listen to yourself and be reflective. Ask yourself, Is your organization working for you? Is your computer organized correctly for the way you work? Do not depend on the way your software is organized. All software has its own organizational principles. Put your information in different places and let these places determine your organization. See, our slides have been bouncing around again. Okay, here we go. The third principle is relevance. And relevance is learning that is important to you now. I often use the word salience in the same context. Salience refers to something that is brighter, that stands out, is more animated. In order to obtain the relevance that you want, you first want to get the content that you need, and then secondly, have it in the place that you want it. So the first step for me, anyways, is to maximize my sources to get information from as many different points of view as possible. So, for example, I read I read hundreds of emails, every day, and I follow more than 1,000 RSS feeds. Now, many people may find that too many, and that's okay. But if you're only listening to one or two or three people during the course of the day, that's too few. The principle here is to create diversity in your sources. To get different perspectives and not always to be hearing information or news from one official source. You can see that this is not just a recipe for learning, it's a recipe for life itself. How boring our lives would be if we sat in the same room every day. life is more interesting and we learn more when we get outside and we look at new things and see new places, talk to new people and see new faces. It doesn't rhyme nearly as nicely in Spanish. The second step is to filter ruthlessly. There are several aspects to this. First of all, even though you're listening to or reading many things at a time, pick and choose those messages that are interesting or relevant or salient to you. You're modeling human perception here. It's like when you look at a forest. You do not look at every single leaf on every single tree. You look at the tiger. That's what's important. Or it's like when you read a newspaper. Very few people, pretty much nobody, reads the newspaper from the very front to the very back, every word of every story. The newspaper is structured so that you can read the headlines and decide on the basis of those headlines which stories to read. And then even the articles are structured that way. The other part of filtering lies in not believing everything you read. This is why it's so important to ensure that what you learn is usable, to ensure that it's simple and it's consistent. Every piece of information we receive, we evaluate against a backdrop of all of our previous knowledge and experiences. That does not mean we only accept into our lives things that we already believe, but it does mean that we reflect critically on any new information that we receive. What I think is really important here is that it is up to you to determine what information is important to you, and it is up to you to determine what makes information true or false, acceptable or not acceptable. Another thing to keep in mind is that the information we receive every day is a flow, like a river, and not a collection of objects like books in a library. people often get caught up in trying to remember things, to remember a precise date or a precise formula. But I don't think you should worry so much about remembering. As a good rule of thumb, if it's really important to you, you will remember it. If it comes up a lot in your life, if it happens a lot in your life, you will remember it. Sorry, I'm not. Somebody keeps advancing my slides. I'm not there yet. No, I'm. I tell you, educators and administrators are the worst behaved people. I'm just kidding. And there he goes again. Stop that. I also, whoever it is keeps doing it, and I don't know. Fighting for control of my own presentation. I'm very precise with my clicks. Anyhow, and there it goes. See, I didn't do that either. What I want to say is also that the relevance of the content or the information is task or function based rather than content based. Function. There's sometimes a distinction made between formal and informal learning, where formal learning, you're trying to learn content, and informal learning, you're trying to learn how to do things. But I think over time we'll discover that even formal learning is more about learning how to do things than learning about content. In any event, we find that we get more relevant information outside of the classroom and in informal activities. What we want to keep in mind is that what we're interested in doing is being, if you will, immersed in the flow of information. The idea here is that as we have repeated experiences, as we try to do things over and over, we acquire customs and habits, and these customs and habits form the basis of our knowledge. Okay. I'm trying to see if there's a list of slides here, but I don't see one. Well, I'll go real fast. Whee! Now I'm here. So what we want to keep in mind is how we learn, the way we learn. We learn by forming connections. Now this is probably what I did. It went real fast and now it's going slow. there we go. The personal learning methodology that I sometimes talk about is aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward. If you think about it, this mechanism involves all elements of personal learning. The aggregate part involves connecting with other people and interacting with them. The remixing and repurposing is converting the knowledge and information into a usable format, consistent and simple. Feeding forward is the act of putting what you have learned into practice, of trying things out and seeing what the result is. So my argument in this presentation is essentially that personal learning is a matter of interactivity, usability, and relevance. And that learning is effective only when these are effective, and these are effective only when you attend to and manage them for yourself. And somewhere in there in the slideshow is a closing slide with my URL on it, www.downs.ca. And you are, of course, all welcome to visit my website anytime. And I thank you for your time and your attention to this talk. And I'd be happy to address any comments or questions. And I'm reading your comments in the chat area. Thank you very much. Yes, I know what they're talking about. I've prepared a set of discussion questions for the chat, and I think they're asking if they can hear the first question now. Is that right? Oh, okay. Okay. Okay, the only students I've had in recent years have been the students that have taken part in the Connectivist courses, like CCK 08, or the Plank course, or, you know, the Massive Open Online courses. In these courses, I communicated with students using a wide range of technologies, including Facebook, but also including, maybe a dozen other technologies. What I found most important for people was that they were comfortable in their own space, using their own technology. People who like Facebook really like Facebook, and they don't like Twitter so much. So for me, the biggest challenge was to not to not privilege any one technology, but to establish a way of communicating with a range of different technologies. And that's all I have for that question. I need some sort of sign, you know, like, all done. Next question. Okay, I'm hearing, or, well, translating, using Google Translate, Luis saying the issue is not so much the range of technologies, but in choosing the most appropriate to the need. And my response would be, who determines the need? How is the need determined? Well, people say that, and then they spend 80% of their time and money on formal education. So even if it's a matter of balance and complementing, I still think we're looking at a significant change in how we address learning today. Right now, I'm copying and pasting from the chat to Google Translate. Okay, I've already done that. Let me think about that. Because there are many different kinds of disruption. Not all disruptions are good. A disruption that shuts down all the roads and the railways, that's not good. A disruption that makes them more efficient, that is good. I'm interested in the sort of change that makes education more accessible and more effective. A lot of people who today speak of the need for disruption in education are not necessarily thinking along the same lines. So simply saying we need disruption is not sufficiently precise. Okay, now I'm reading disruption in the sense of change to build something important and let go of the previous contamination. Yeah, that would be more my sense of, let's call it progressive disruption. I'm looking it up on Google to see if it's been used. Nope, I think it's ours. All right, I declare that we're after progressive disruption. Ways of improving the education system by increasing access. And I contrast that with types of disruption that turn education into a shopping mall. Okay, now. I'm copying again and translating. Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is yes, there is always a risk of losing something important when you filter. This is why it's important to be connected to a number of people and not just one person, and for those people to be connected with each other as well. Because I'm looking for paper here. See, these are people, right? And an idea goes from one person to the next, and then through to you. Now, if you're filtering, it might not make it through that last link. But if we have a connected network, now, if we have a connected network, then there are multiple ways for a single signal or a single idea to go from the source to you, right? And then it becomes a matter of probability whether it gets from the source to you. So it's not so much a matter of your filtering, it's the probability of the signal making it through the network. It is because the network functions in this way that you can filter so ruthlessly. If you think about it, if you listen to only one person, you must listen to everything they say, just in case, because they'll only say each thing once. But if you're listening to multiple people, then the message may get through any number of those people. And even if you miss it once, if it's an important message, the odds are very good that you'll see it when it comes through again. Those in Portuguese. Okay, somebody's saying, unfortunately, schools could have stopped everything today to hear this theme expounded by Stephen. That's in Portuguese. And then Roberta's saying, our schools are places for building learning for life. Yes. Yeah. And they should be. And it's important over time to understand that schools are teaching people how to learn, or they should be teaching people how to learn. I was thinking of that this morning when I was getting ready for this talk, and it was a direction the talk didn't take, but it could have, thinking about the subjects that are taught in school. Let's take mathematics, for example. And a student goes to school and studies mathematics, and we know that mathematics is full of formulas and things that you have to remember, right? But when you talk to a mathematics teacher and you ask the teacher, well, why are you teaching calculus? They won't ever use calculus. The teacher always responds, and I think correctly, that I'm not teaching calculus. I'm teaching them a way of thinking about the world. Why is that important? Well, if you look at two shapes, if you have mathematical education, you know why those two shapes are different. You know that one of them expresses a simple sine and the other one expresses a polynomial or whatever. If you don't have mathematical knowledge, you don't understand how those shapes are different. You just understand that they're different. And what the mathematics instructor is trying to teach is not how those two shapes are different, but in understanding that there are ways of knowing how these shapes are different. And if you understand that you're teaching ways of seeing the world, then you approach your subject differently than if you're teaching a bunch of facts to be remembered. And it's not just mathematics. In English classes in Canada, they teach students the works of William Shakespeare. And again, they're not teaching them to remember stuff that's inside William Shakespeare's works. They're teaching them a way of seeing language. When you've read Shakespeare and you understand Shakespeare, you acquire a set of metaphors, expressions, and idioms. To be or not to be, for example. And these expressions, metaphors, and idioms form a subtext beneath the literal text of all English. And what's important is not understanding that particular subtext, but understanding in general that language has a subtext, that one word can have many meanings depending on your different perspective. It's this deeper learning that you miss if you just teach facts. That's why it's important that school teachers understand they're teaching ways of seeing the world, not just facts about the world. Okay, and I see we have a question in, what is that, Arabic? Oh, it's in Hindi. Oh, but it translates as rude. Let's see what else we have here. Something about the curriculum. There's a discussion going back and forth here in the chat area. Okay, let's see. I've got something here from Celeste. Something about taught how to learn, no previous. Okay. And I see that argument a lot, especially in the American press, the American writing about education. And the argument is something like, first you have to have content, because you can't learn anything unless you have content knowledge. Which is true. If I didn't know the meanings of any words, I could never utter a sentence. And if I could never utter a sentence, I could never learn how to read sentences. So I have to know what words mean. That was an impressive feat of memory on the part of the translator. Yeah. But the question is, which words must you learn? And the answer is, it doesn't matter. In Canada, when I was growing up, we learned to read using a book called Fun with Dick and Jane. And I almost have it memorized. Look at Jane. See Jane run. Run, Jane, run. And we learned basic words and basic sentences using the words Dick, Jane, run, fun, see, those kind of words. Other children at other times can learn English reading Dr. Seuss, for example, hop on pop. Yeah, hop on pop. Yes. Oh, no? Oh. it's a classic. So, and the point here is, I could use see Jane run, or I could use hop on pop. I need content to form sentences, but it doesn't matter which content. And this generalizes. The idea here is that we identify a domain of inquiry or a practice or an activity, and we immerse ourselves in that domain of activity or practice or environment. then through that process of immersion and in communicating and interacting with other people, some of which are more expert, others which are less expert, we can acquire the tools we need in order to learn and to learn how to learn. If you were a student, I would be saying to you, look at how the experts learn. Look at how they learn and attempt to model or emulate that practice. And if you are an expert and you want your students to learn, I would say model the practice of how you learn so that they have something to see and to follow. See, a lot of people represent learning how to learn as sort of some set of facts you need to know before you can start to learn. But it doesn't work that way. Learning how to learn is very iterative. It's back and forth, right? It's back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. The person who knows how to learn and the person who's learning how to learn, they interact back and forth. And the one person models how to learn and then the other person follows that model back and forth. So there isn't some body of knowledge that you first have before you learn how to learn. You learn how to learn gradually and iteratively. And I hope that responded to that question. Okay. Thank you, everyone. I really enjoyed this. And that's the end of the presentation. Sorry, I didn't have the other side, but it was just a little complicated. But there is a recording that's on the Fundación Telefónica website, EducaRed, and I'll be looking for it. And if I can't get that, I'll put that up.